This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, a look at the life and work of Charles Darwin in the years following his voyage on the Beagle. We will get a look at how Darwin came to his theory of evolution and natural selection as the key mechanism of evolutionary change. Our guest is writer and science journalist David Quammen. In his new book, The Reluctant Mr. Darwin, Quammen calls Darwin's discovery of natural selection a deeply radical insight from a deeply cautious man. Quammen writes, "Many people, even among those who would say they accept Darwin's theory of evolution, they decline to absorb the full implications of what he wrote. According to Darwin's view, natural selection is a purposeless process, but an efficacious one. Impersonal, blind to the future, it has no goals, only results." That from the introduction to David Quammen's book, The Reluctant Mr. Darwin. And that excerpt hints at the discomfort that many people feel about evolution when it comes without the guidance of a creator. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Our guest, David Quammen, is the author of four books of fiction, four collections of essays, and three books of nonfiction, including Monster of God and The Song of the Dodo. His new book, The Reluctant Mr. Darwin, An Intimate Portrait of Charles Darwin and the Making of His Theory of Evolution, is part of the Great Discoveries series from Atlas Books, a division of W.W. Norton. Again, listeners, questions, comments invited for our guest, David Quammen. Here are the phone numbers, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. David Quammen, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's good to be with you, Celeste.
The focus of our discussion this afternoon will be on Darwin's life and work after the voyage aboard Beagle. But I think it would be useful to recall that voyage here at the start. It lasted for almost 5 years, beginning in 1831. Where did the Beagle sail with Darwin aboard?
Right. Well, Darwin was fresh out of college, and he got this offer to go along and sailed with the Beagle, which was a British naval survey ship. And the Beagle spent most of its time going up and down the coast of South America, first the eastern coast, then the western coast. Its captain, Robert Fitzroy, was assigned to do naval surveying of the coastline and the harbors there. That was the primary mission. And it was only, a secondary opportunity that the Beagle ended up sailing homeward by going around the backside of the planet and crossing the Pacific and stopping at a few interesting places, including most famously the Galapagos Islands.
Okay, and give us some sense of what he accomplished in his years of that voyage.
Well, when he set out, as I said, Darwin was just out of college. He had done the basic sort of classics curriculum at Cambridge University, which in those days was essentially an Anglican seminary, and he was prepared for almost nothing except becoming an Anglican clergyman in a small parish somewhere in England. That's what he thought his future was going to be. Not that he was especially devout, but he was a second son, and that looked like it was going to be his career. And then, but he had a little bit of training in natural history, a little bit of training in geology, and he went off on the Beagle partly because they thought it would be nice to have someone with a little bit of geological background to help make observations. And he trained himself in the course of the 4 years, 9 months, and 5 days on the Beagle to be a very, very skilled, acute, disciplined observer, not just of geology, but of natural history, to gather facts and to start to look at patterns and ask questions.
Okay. Now, when he returned to England, you point out his work was just beginning, even though that voyage was quite a long one. And you say there was no eureka moment for Charles Darwin.
Right. The usual, people tend to assume that, well, Darwin went off on the Beagle, they stopped in the Galapagos, he saw the finches, suddenly he realized that species must evolve, and he came up with his theory and sailed home. But it wasn't like that at all. He didn't know what he was looking for. He wasn't an evolutionist when he headed off on the Beagle. He was very conventional in his thinking. And as he came home from the Beagle, he started to have doubts about one of the central dogmas, not just of religious orthodoxy, but of natural history, and that was that species are fixed. Species are essential and unchangeable forms created by God in the recent past and immutable. That was the belief that Darwin began to doubt on the basis of his observations in the Galapagos and elsewhere. And as he sailed home, he wrote one little note to himself in his ornithological notes to the effect that if it's possible that species aren't fixed, are mutable, then this carried some very, very interesting implications, and it was those implications that he began to explore when he got home.
Yeah. So many questions, so many unknowns. How did he begin to go about finding his answers? Where did he begin when he returned home to Britain?
He began in two ways. First of all, he began with the specimens that he had brought back from the Beagle voyage, including the ones from the Galapagos. He farmed those out to a number of experts in London, the bird specimens to a bird expert, the reptiles to a reptile fellow, etc. He wasn't a specialist in all those fields himself, and he essentially didn't know what he had collected. He had a lot of bird skins and mammal pelts and fossils and pickled fish. And so he gave those to experts to do the identifying and the classifying, and then the experts started to come back to him with some interesting information. For instance, the fellow who had the birds, a fellow named John Gould, told Darwin, you know all those brown birds that you collected from the Galapagos? Well, it turns out there are 13 different species in that one group of brown birds that all look pretty much the same, but they are distinct, as recognizable by different beak shapes and other subtle factors. 13 different species. They're all finches. They're all previously unknown to science, and this was news to Darwin.
What impact did Gould's insights about those bird specimens have on him?
Gould's insights, along with some of the other things that he heard from the other specialists, made him start to doubt the idea that species were fixed and start to believe that if these closely related species, closely related but distinct species, were living near one another on a series of islands in the middle of the Pacific, it seemed too strange, too coincidental that an all-powerful and busily interventionist God would have created species so much alike and put them in one place. It seemed to him that it was more plausible, more economical to think that maybe these species had diverged from one another in this remote archipelago.
Now, intellectually, that had to be exhilarating. On the other hand, he might have also thought, this is blasphemous.
Absolutely. That's what he did think. And he started keeping a series of small notebooks, small pocket-sized leather-bound notebooks, each with a metal clasp, and he called these his transmutation notebooks. He started the first one in July of 1837, just months after he was back from the Beagle. He was living as a single young man in London at that point, on an allowance from his father. Reading, becoming part of the scientific societies, and beginning to meditate on this question of whether species are fixed or changeable. So he started writing notes, recording facts, brainstorming in the first of these transmutation notebooks, and that's where he, among other things, speaking to himself, confided the fact that if it's true that species are mutable, then this overturns one of the central tenets of all of the scientific and religious belief that he had been taught. And he wrote one word to himself in Portuguese that he had picked up in Brazil, cuidado, be careful.
Yeah. David Quammen is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is The Reluctant Mr. Darwin, an intimate portrait of Charles Darwin and the making of his theory of evolution. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting for us in Champaign. Juan, good afternoon.
Yes, thank you. I wonder if the author is familiar with the work of cell biologist Bruce Lipton, and also the relatively new field of epigenetics, which looks at the role of regulatory proteins on determining how the genes will be used, and also on how mutation takes place and evolution progresses, and that this research shows or seems to suggest at least very strongly that, in fact, random mutation is not the driving force behind evolution, but rather the environmental pressures are what drive evolution. And this really seems to go back and reinforce the evolutionary theory of Jean-Baptiste Delamarck, who actually preceded Darwin by 50 years, and that, in fact, it's not a matter of a struggle and survival of the fittest, but rather it's a matter of cooperation that drives the evolutionary process, and not that there isn't evolution, but it's driven by a very different way, and that has very profound implications in terms of how we think about just about everything.
The two thoughts going on there. One is the Lamarckian idea of inheritance of acquired characteristics, which actually goes back before Lamarck, but you're right, it was certainly one of the aspects of Lamarck's theory. And it is also something that that Darwin incorporated into The Origin of Species, although it's generally considered to be one of the mistakes that he made. But the idea has never gone away. It's certainly, it seems to have come back every 30 or 40 years, people finding new evidence, wanting to believe in the idea that environment does elicit not just random mutations, but adaptive mutations, and that those are heritable. What's the fellow's name that you mentioned, Lipton?
Yeah, Bruce Lipton.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with his work, but I am familiar with others who have brought back this idea, this speculation, in recent years. It's a fascinating possibility. As I say, it doesn't ever seem to go away completely, and even Darwin was susceptible to it. He did not call it the inheritance of acquired characteristics. He called it the effects of use and disuse. But with all due respect to Bruce Lipton, virtually all the scientists I know of continue to reject the notion that acquired characteristics can be inherited, although there are some, I agree, there are some blurry cases, for instance, in the cases when a virus affects the reproductive cells of an organism.
Well, certainly we found that out with the research into HIV. But you might want to check out, the research is going on in the field of epigenetics, and also that, it has been found that, in fact, these random mutations that happen from time to time, actually our biology has a way of repairing them, and that itself is another thing that has strongly brought into question this idea of gene determinism and the random mutation as a driving force of evolution. But thank you very much.
Mm.
Thanks for the call this afternoon.
Celeste, let me just add one thing that I was going to say, and that is that the caller was really talking about two ideas, both of them interesting, not necessarily essentially related. And the second one he mentioned was the fact that, according to this idea, it was cooperation more than competition that drives evolution by natural selection. And I don't see that that idea is logically connected to the first, the bit about the inheritance of acquired characteristics. But this is a discussion that goes in a million different ways and a can of worms that we probably can't open too far this afternoon.
Right, okay. Now, not to leave anyone behind, tell us a little bit more about Jean-Baptiste Lamarck and what Darwin thought of his work.
Lamarck was a Frenchman working, as the caller said, about 50 years before Darwin. He published in about 1800, 1801, a theory of evolution that involved a number of different elements. One was this notion of the inheritance of acquired characteristics, and put in the most simple examples, that means, for instance, that the daughter born to a blacksmith is going to have big muscles because her father has acquired big muscles in the course of his life. And generally that's thought to be firmly established as not being true. Lamarck talked about that, and he also talked about some almost mystical things like the effect of nervous fluids in bringing about adaptations that are needed by a given species in a given environment. Darwin thought Lamarck, at one point he talked about he was not going to indulge in Lamarckian nonsense. He dismissed Lamarck because Lamarck's theory of evolution didn't involve a persuasive physical causal mechanism. That was the important thing about Darwin's theory. Other people, Lamarck, Darwin's own grandfather, Erasmus, and some others, had proposed the idea of evolution, but no one before Darwin came up with a persuasive physical explanation for how evolution occurs.
Hmm. Was Darwin an avid reader?
Oh yeah, he read in every direction. He read a wide variety of sources, both in science, in philosophy, travel and expeditionary literature. He was reading all of those things. For instance, during those early years back in London when he was working on these transmutation notebooks.
Hmm. Writing was also important to Darwin, important in how he reached conclusions. You tell readers, as a matter of fact, that when thinking about marriage, he wrote out his thoughts, pro and con. Would you talk about the role writing played in Darwin's investigations?
Well, he worked through his ideas by, as I said, brainstorming to himself in these notebooks. That's on the scientific side. And I say in the book he was also almost nerdishly systematic. And when he began thinking about whether or not he should get married, which was before he really had a candidate, he just decided in the abstract that it was time to give marriage some thought. He made a list and listed the pros and the cons on a sheet of paper, to marry, not to marry. And when he first did this, he came up mostly with cons, mostly with disadvantages. He thought that he was not going to be able to afford to live comfortably if he got married. He didn't realize how generous his wealthy father was. And he made this whole list of disadvantages. He wouldn't be able to buy books. He wouldn't be able to go on summer vacations to the continent. He wouldn't be able to travel to America. He wouldn't be able to make big biological collections if he were married, because he imagined himself living in a small house in London with a wife and a growing family of children and just sort of scraping by.
But that view evolved.
It evolved. He got more and more intensely confused and excited by his evolutionary ideas and these thoughts about marriage and how to make a living, and went off to Scotland on a geological field trip, and then stopped and saw his father back home in the town of Shrewsbury. And his father, he talked to his father about this, and his father essentially told him, "Charles, relax. You're going to have plenty of money. It's going to come from me. You should get married while you're still young enough to enjoy the children, and there will be money." And this came as a great relief and an eye-opening discovery to Darwin. And then he made another list of pros and cons of getting married. And son of a gun, this time, there were more advantages than disadvantages.
And one of the things he wrote, only picture to yourself a nice, soft wife on a sofa with good fire and books and music, perhaps.
Right.
Quite
That's
a change.
How he thought of it. Yeah. Another point, he said, having a wife, well, it would be, quote, better than a dog anyhow. This was not a love match when he began his marriage, but it turned his marriage to his cousin Emma, which occurred soon after that. She was the one he settled on, and it started very tepidly, but over the course of their lives, it grew into a very, very close, loving, essential relationship that was at the center of his personal life.
Yeah. Now, Emma Wedgwood, his wife, was a fervent Christian, a fervent believer in the Bible.
She was. And when he proposed to her, it came as a great surprise to her because he had never really shown much interest in her. She was his first cousin, but that wasn't unusual in those days for first cousins to marry. And the family thought, well, this is perfect, Charles and Emma. Sure, this will be nice. But it wasn't so perfect because, as you say, she was a fervent, Bible-embracing Christian, and he was now falling away into skepticism, into disbelief, into what eventually would become agnosticism. And he shared that fact with her at this point, this early point. And she said in a letter to him soon afterwards, well, this represents a painful void between us, but as she put it, sincere doubts cannot be considered sin, and she was willing to marry him anyway.
How did they deal with that conflict through the course of their marriage?
This seems to have been very tricky, but they dealt with it successfully, probably by simply not talking about it much. Emma was very, very important to him. She was his nursemaid and protectress, as well as his wife and the mother of his children. But she doesn't ever seem to have been a full intellectual partner or soulmate. She didn't really share the scientific work with him step by step, and he never forced her to confront it. He delayed, and this is one of the reasons that, for the word reluctant in my title, he delayed for 21 years before publishing his theory after he hit upon his theory. And there were a couple different reasons for that, but one of them seems to have been his realization that this was going to be very discomforting to his wife, Emma.
Yeah. And you also note that he was a cautious man, and that was called for at this time in history. But at the same time, it had to have been very difficult to live this double life.
It was tricky for him. But he was, besides being cautious, a perfectionist, and he didn't want to rush his theory of evolution into print until he had assembled a mass of supporting data and carefully refined arguments so that when he did publish, he would put the idea across. As I said earlier, there were some previous theorists of evolution. None of them had a fully articulated physical theory, and they had been dismissed as sort of cranks. And also, evolution was considered a politically radical idea. It was became entangled with some of the progressive politics of the day. And Darwin was a liberal fellow, but he certainly was no radical. So all of these factors contributed to him moving slowly, moving carefully, moving deliberately toward the final moment of publication, which didn't come for 21 years.
Yeah. Interesting to realize in reading your book that at one point here in this point in time, studying nature was seen as a pious venture.
It was. The term in those days was natural theology. There was no profession of biology. The word biologist didn't even exist at this point. Most of natural history research was done, or much of it anyway, was done by people who had been trained, as he had been trained, toward being an Anglican clergyman. Some of the most important scientists even were ordained clergymen, including some of his own teachers. So that when he finally did publish, and as he moved toward publishing, it was never a question of science versus religion. The point was that Darwin's theories went against not just the religious orthodoxy, but the scientific orthodoxy of his day, which was closely entangled with religious orthodoxy through this body of thought called natural theology, which viewed the study of nature as a path toward piety.
When did the word evolution begin to be used, per se? Because Darwin was careful early in the going to use the word transmutation in his writings.
Right. And evolution in those days meant something a little bit different. He did not use the word evolution for decades. As you say, he talked about transmutation. The other terms for the same set of ideas were the development theory, descent, the theory of descent with modification. In the first edition of The Origin of Species, published in 1859, at the very end, he talked about, in the last sentence, as a matter of fact, he talked about this evidence that from a simplicity of original forms, new species have been and are being evolved. So the last word of the book is evolved, and that was as close as he came for years to using the formulation evolution.
Now, the idea had been with him since 1838, and then The Origin of the Species not published until 1859. Maybe you would give us you've already talked about this a little bit, but maybe you'd give us a better idea of what was happening in those 21 years. What was he working on?
He was busy with some of the chores, the follow-up chores to the Beagle Voyage. He wrote his own account of the Beagle Voyage, which we know now as the book The Voyage of the Beagle, published that, published a number of other books, one on coral reefs that also came from the Beagle Voyage. And then he got distracted by the subject of barnacles. He had brought back a few barnacles from the voyage, and he had one in a little bottle that he decided it was important for him to taxonomically identify. So he started working on this strange barnacle form, and he thought this might be the chore of a few weeks or maybe a month. And he realized as he got into it that the classification of barnacles was in disarray, and somebody needed to do a revision of the entire group of animals. And he decided to take it on himself. So he spent 8 years becoming essentially the world expert on the taxonomy of living and extinct barnacles, and published 4 volumes on that. All the while, his evolutionary theory was sitting on the shelf in a rough draft form, unknown to anybody except himself and a few friends that he had confided in. And eventually, he came back around after all these years and started work on a big volume that was going to explode upon the world with his theory of evolution.
How confident was he in his ideas?
He was very confident and became more confident as time went on. He was looking at a number of different kinds of data. As I said, he was looking at biogeography, which essentially means the patterns of where species live on the planet, which species live where and don't live where and why. He was looking at morphology and anatomy, the similarities, the homologies among species that suggest that they have common origins. For instance, the flipper of a whale has 5 bones in it. The paw of a bear has 5 bones in it. And our hand has 5 sets of bones in it, all suggesting 5 digits. Why was that? Well, his explanation was common origins. So he was gathering all this information, and as he gathered it, he became more and more convinced that he was right about this theory.
As you mentioned very early in the interview, Charles Darwin might have become a member of the clergy had it not been for that voyage that he made beginning in 1831. So did he feel at all a loss when he realized, I'm a materialist?
He said later in life, I never gave up Christianity until I was 40 years of age. That would have been in about 1849. He hadn't yet published The Origin of Species, but he was well along in his gathering of information. So he remembered it as having happened as a gradual process. In fact, he said it was so gradual that
he never really noticed it was happening, his loss of the Christian faith, and that when the process was complete, he felt no discomfort whatsoever and had never doubted himself afterward.
Hmm. Very interesting. This is the Afternoon Magazine. David Quammen, our guest today. His latest book is The Reluctant Mr. Darwin, an intimate portrait of Charles Darwin, and the making of his theory of evolution. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon with a telephone call. If you've got a question or a comment for our guest, David Quammen, give us a call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Listener waiting for us in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Yes, I'm just curious. What do you think Darwin would have thought of the Hobbit man?
Help me remember this. This is a small human from...
Yes.
Was it Java or Sumatra?
I'll spell it for you. It's Homo F-L-O-R-E-S-I-E-N-S-I-E.
All right.
S.
Right. Flores. Floresiensis, right?
Right.
Homo floresiensis, right. Very interesting find in the last couple of years. A form of hominid closely related to Homo sapiens known only from these fossils on the island of Flores. And I think Darwin would have been fascinated by this, and he would have found it quite supportive of the idea of evolution as he was articulating it. One of the things that is found on islands all over the world is a tendency toward gigantism or dwarfism.
Right.
Mammals tend to get smaller on islands. Pygmy deer, pygmy hippopotamuses, pygmy bears. Reptiles tend to get larger. Giant tortoises in the Galapagos, giant tortoises on the Seychelles Islands and Aldabra in the Indian Ocean. So this this phenomenon of size change among island populations and island species as they evolve is very familiar, very much part of the overall picture. But to have it reaffirmed with this discovery of hominid fossils just in the last few years was unexpected, but delightfully reinforcing, I would say.
Yeah, 3.5 feet tall and about 55 pounds is what the numbers are.
Right, yeah.
Very interesting.
If you had said to any biologist who studies islands, and if you had said to islands, and if you had said to Darwin, if we were to discover a pygmy or a dwarf species of hominid, where would you expect it to be? Then the answer would be not in Africa, not in Asia, but on a smallish island somewhere.
Yeah, Indonesian islands is where this was.
Yeah.
Oh. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're very welcome. Did Charles Darwin, did he have rivals, adversaries, prior to publication of The Origin of the Species?
He had one. He wasn't aware that he had rivals moving toward a theory of evolution. But in fact, there was a young fellow named Alfred Russel Wallace, unknown to Darwin, who was working as a collector, a professional collector of specimens, out in the Malay archipelago, what we now call Indonesia, speaking of Indonesia. And he was there seeing amazing patterns, again, partly because any archipelago of islands tends to show evolutionary patterns more starkly, more dramatically, more bizarrely than the mainlands do. And Wallace himself, in 1858, came upon the idea of evolution by natural selection, although he didn't call it natural selection. This is before Darwin had published. Wallace was looking for an explanation of how species might evolve. He hit on that idea. He wrote a manuscript. He mailed it to the one person back in England who had been a little bit friendly to him as a pen pal, and he knew, as he thought, a conventional naturalist, and that was Charles Darwin. Mm-hmm. So suddenly this manuscript from this unknown fellow shows up in Darwin's own mailbox, along with a letter saying, "Dear Mr. Darwin,
please take a look at this manuscript. If you think it's crazy, forget it. But if you think it has any merit whatsoever, please pass it along. And Darwin thought, oh my gosh, all of my originality has been smashed. I've been scooped. I've delayed too long, and now this young fellow has come up with my idea, and I'm duty-bound to let him see it into publication. Darwin's friends then said, calm down, Charles, and they arranged a joint reading of Wallace's paper and some excerpts from Darwin's unpublished work so that the official announcement of this idea occurred in July 1st, 1858 at the Linnaean Society, and it was shared by Darwin and Wallace. And then Darwin moved ahead quickly after that and wrote a short version of the long book that he'd been working on. And the short version, the quick and dirty version, was then published under the title On the Origin of Species.
Mm. Alfred Wallace was doing some testing of the waters with this letter to Darwin. How did Darwin test the waters with his ideas early on prior to?
Well, he wrote a draft of his species theory in 1842, which was almost just a bullet point outline. Again, this is about 5 years after being back from the Beagle. And then in 2 years later, he wrote a fuller draft that fleshed it out, and then he set that aside. Eventually, he showed it to one or two friends to get their reaction to it, and they thought, well, you may be crazy, but it's an important idea, and if it's true, it's really important, so you should go ahead and publish it. But he continued to delay. So although he had gotten some encouragement from Joseph Hooker in particular, his closest scientific friend, he still let this idea sit on the shelf for what amounted to 21 years until finally Wallace came along and provoked him to move into print.
Mm. Let's take another call. Listener in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Oh, hi, how are you doing? I was curious if you'd heard anything about Gregor Mendel sending Darwin a letter after The Origin of Species was published and referencing his research on genetics, and if Darwin ever saw that. I picked that up somewhere a year or so ago, and I'm wondering if you knew anything about that.
Let me back up and explain the background of your question a little bit. Gregor Mendel was a monk working in a small town in what's now Czechoslovakia, and performing experiments with pea plants. And by doing those in the early 1860s, he came up with the basic principles of inheritance, what we now call Mendelian inheritance. Very, very important in terms of dominant and recessive, well, genes is the term we use now. All of this was unknown to Darwin. Mendel published one little paper in the local Natural History Society bulletin. And in terms of, I mean, it would have been hugely helpful to Darwin if he had known about Mendel's work, and he didn't. Virtually no one did. It wasn't rediscovered until 1900. But the idea that Mendel wrote to Darwin and said, you should take a look at my paper, I think is apocryphal. There is no letter to that effect in the massive Cambridge University Press edition of Darwin's letters. It would be big news if that letter actually existed and had been examined by reputable historians, and it doesn't seem to have been. So it's unfortunate that Darwin didn't read Mendel, or if he did read Mendel, he didn't get the significance. But as far as I know, there's no epistolary evidence that Mendel ever called it to his attention.
Oh, yeah, thanks. I was wondering about that because, somewhere along the line I'd read something about this letter, but I wanted to ask you something else about prior to Darwin, when Darwin came up with The Origin of Species and his theory of what we later call evolution, in my opinion on that, it's more like less like he saw the natural process in things, process being, you know, capital P, more of a noun instead of a verb. And prior to Darwin, was there such a way of thinking about process in that, you know, you go from not just biological process, but, you know, how things are processional and the way things work socially and things like that. I'm wondering, is there anything in your reading or writing about him that you sort of saw prior to Darwin there was some sort of like intellectual idea underpinning the word process? Could you talk about that?
Well, I can't...
I can't tell you anything specifically about that word reverberating through his thinking or the thinking of his predecessors. There's certainly, he was very, very interested in the idea that the universe is governed by physical laws. That was his deepest seated conviction, deeper even than his belief in evolution, the idea that, that the universe functions according to unchangeable physical laws, and that there are no such thing as miracles, and that even if there might be a deity who would set the universe in motion, he couldn't accept the idea that a deity would intervene and temporarily suspend his own physical laws. But that's a little different from what you're talking about, process. There were, in some of the earlier evolutionists, there was a sense that the universe had evolved, a recognition that the universe had evolved, as well as organic forms evolving. But they didn't, as far as I'm aware, didn't pay any particular attention to the word process.
Yeah. Okay, I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. What was the immediate reaction to the origin of the species?
Well, there was it was a complex reaction. Some people, first of all, the book was a success. It was a hit. It sold out in its first edition, at least at the wholesale level, on the day of publication. So it was scooped up by readers in England who found it very exciting. Most of them found it very persuasive and eye-opening. There were negative reviews and negative reactions, some from clergymen, some from some of those theologically grounded scientific colleagues and teachers of Darwin himself. And over the course of the next 10 or 20 years, a peculiar thing happened, and that is that people all over the, at least the English-speaking world, came to accept the idea of evolution, the idea that species had evolved and were evolving, because Darwin had presented such a compelling argument for it in The Origin of Species. And yet, by the end of the century, it's possible to notice that they had rejected the idea of natural selection as the causal mechanism. And this is one of the things that people don't generally realize, that the success of the full Darwinian theory, that evolution occurred and that natural selection is its primary causal mechanism, didn't really take place until the 1930s, when Darwinian theory was united with Mendelian genetics, the work by Mendel that the earlier caller mentioned, and with several other aspects of biology to create what's called the modern synthesis of neo-Darwinian theory.
And the idea of natural selection, it still is so uncomfortable for so many people today.
It's still, it's an amazing feat that Darwin performed 150 years ago, coming up with an idea that now is still central to biology, is still correct, and yet is still so controversial, so difficult, so discomforting to a lot of people. And I think, Celeste, the reason it's discomforting is because although natural selection is an order-creating process, one of the aspects of it are the random mutations upon which it functions. And the idea that the mutations that create variation within populations, that they are random, goes directly against the idea that there was a divine plan leading toward the human species and investing the human species with an immortal soul. That's that's where the central conflict is between Darwinian evolutionary theory and what so many people believe.
Yeah, as you put it so eloquently and elegantly, in plain language, a soul or no soul, an afterlife or not. Are humans spiritually immortal in a way that chickens and cows aren't, or just another form of temporarily animated meat?
The peculiar thing, I guess, about this book is that, there are 1,000 books about Darwin that have been published, and some people have asked me, why another? Well, because most people, certainly most Americans, have never read one of those 1,000 books about Darwin. So I wanted to write a book that was Darwin for everybody, a book that lots of people would be comfortable with, a book that's radically concise and yet substantive and readable. Not Darwin for dummies, but Darwin for smart people who are busy. And that's what I hope this book is.
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, at the core of it, there are some genuinely
scary, challenging ideas that go against what a lot of people believe.
Yeah. As well as a really fascinating look at Darwin's daily life and who he was as a human being.
Well, he was such a good fellow, and I'm sure you've felt that from reading it. A cautious man, as I say, with a revolutionary idea, a gentleman, a generous man, an extraordinarily honest and hardworking man. Probably not a genius in the term, in the sense that most people use that word, but a man with incredible integrity and decency. And I found myself just feeling more affection for him, more respect toward him as the project went on.
Yeah, very good. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. David, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
A real pleasure talking with you, Celeste.
David Quammen has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author, most recently, of The Reluctant Mr. Darwin, an intimate portrait of Charles Darwin and the making of his theory of evolution. The book is part of the Great Discoveries series from Atlas Books. Atlas Books is a division of W.W. Norton.